Good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the State of Delaware, the appellant in this matter. Many times I come here trying to defend the actions of a Superior Court judge. In this case, unfortunately, I can't do that. Because
over 95% of the time.
We're right. Well, this may be that 5%, Your Honor, where I have to suggest that the Superior Court got it wrong here. And this case poses a very interesting issue that really hasn't been squarely dealt with, and that is, what does great deference mean? And what is the standard of review, if there's a standard of review that a Superior Court judge uses when he or she reviews a affidavit of probable cause? And in searching the Delaware case law, we say great deference, we talk about it time and again, but we really don't come down to saying, what does that mean when they look at it?
We got to that standard. You know, normally in our other areas of the law, when the court reviews a paper record on a motion to dismiss, or the court reviews a paper record on a motion for summary judgment, and there's no deference because we say, you know, we can read the paper record the way the trial court reads the paper record. And this seems to be somewhat different, and I agree that's where the law is now, but how do we get to this idea that even though the magistrate is reviewing a paper record, that review is entitled to great deference on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that idea of great deference, one, starts with Illinois versus Gates and the totality of the circumstances test, which this court has adopted, and all of the federal case law and the state case law that says that basically a court looks for a substantial basis. But it finds its core in the idea that we want to incentivize using warrants. We want to ensure that the police go for a warrant and in all circumstances in which it's called for instance, in the search of a home, and that if we use some hyper-technical analysis of it where we are nitpicking each one and trying to excuse make, which I suggest respectfully happened here, for other ways to look at what the magistrate saw, what we do is we tell the police, well, it doesn't matter, because unless you are a Dickens-like writer, unless you get it exactly right and answer every question or negative inference that anybody is going to raise, why get a warrant? Why not just come up with some non-warrant reason, some exigency instead?
You're telling us that the police, instead of getting a search warrant for a residence, will, in lieu of that, come up with a pretext to search a residence under some exception to the search warrant requirement.
Well, Your Honor, that's what the original Illinois versus Gates and those types of cases spoke to, that very concern that we want to ensure that we use a common sense, practical standard in reviewing this.
I just don't accept the proposition that the police are not going to follow the law, or that the police will manufacture a pretext.
I don't either. I work with police day in and day out, and I believe that they are good, honest men and women, and they will follow the law. But the idea that we should ensure that, for instance, in a call like this, here's what happened. At 8:20, they see this, what they believe to be a oxycodone buy out of Mr. Holden's house.
They didn't know what was being bought at that time, did they?
They did not.
Something was.
Yes, they, from the totality of the circumstances of their investigation, what they had heard from two separate confidential sources who spoke about what Mr. Holden did, and as far as we know, they were totally independent from two different agencies. We have the Wilmington confidential source who has called and started in December 15th of 2010 saying, look, Michael Holden is selling out of his house. He's still selling marijuana. He's now selling pills also, and he has a particular car.
But reflects, with regard to both of these confidential informants, no one had ever seen Holden with drugs. And as I read the record, I'm not sure anyone had ever even been in his house. So that's two simple questions. Did either of these confidential informants ever actually see Holden with drugs?
I cannot say from this record that they did. What we know is the first confidential source from Wilmington PD actually spoke to Holden. That's what it says in the affidavit of probable cause.
I understand.
I've spoken to Holden, and here's what he's telling me. And here's what I know from what he's telling me.
We're looking at probable cause that there were drugs in the house.
Yes.
And so my question is, at least on this record, as I read it, neither one of these confidential informants ever saw Holden with drugs. You agree on the record. Now, my next question is, had either one ever been in his house?
One, and I don't want to back off on the first question, they never said they saw drugs. I can tell you that.
Well, we're looking at this
from the conversation that they're having when they say, I've spoken to Holden, and then they start to talk about his activity. We cannot say from the averments in the affidavit, they said, I know this because I saw it. That's true. We cannot say, I know this because I have been in his house. It is not worded that way.
Yeah,
it is worded in them.
My question was simply for clarification. We're looking at an affidavit.
Yes.
And I just want to be sure I understand the record in the affidavit does not allege that they ever saw drugs. There's no allegation in the affidavit that they ever saw him with drugs.
Yes.
And is there any allegation that they were even in his house?
No, there is none. However, they speak, obviously you could read it two ways, though. Not that they say, I know this because I was in his house, but the way they speak about him, it is obviously someone who he trusts greatly. Because he's talking about, I beat this before, here's how I'm changing up, I'm changing from using my car to deliver to my residence because I'm afraid, because I got stopped in February. And so he's moved his activity into the residence. Whether or not they know this because they actually saw it and were inside, or whether they know it simply because he told them, I agree. There is no averment one way or the other to make that clear.
Does the affidavit show that they surveilled the house, and is the inference that it was a competent surveillance so they were not detected, and that they never saw anyone other than
The surveillance, there are three incidents of, quote, surveillance. One on January 5th. And they said we set up surveillance and saw the car that the first confidential source had told them about. The first confidential source tells them he's driving a particular car. It's registered to the girlfriend. It's a white Chrysler. It has Maryland registration. They actually go to the house, and they say they set up surveillance and they see the house. It's not clear what the level of surveillance is and what they were there for, whether it's just we went by the house and saw the car there and left, or we sat there for hours to see what type of activity is going on. There's no way to tell one way or the other in the averment. It's a one-paragraph averment, and what they say is checked out, saw that very car, then went back to Delgis, ran it, and lo and behold, it's in the name Joseph Lusby, who they assume must be the father-in-law of the girlfriend.
Can we go back to the standard review for just a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
You quoted the reference from our case law to the Superior Court's standard of review of the magistrate's review of the affidavit. Is our review of the Superior Court the same standard?
Well, this court determines whether or not the Superior Court abuses discretion when it, in fact, granted the suppression. However, when you read the cases on warrants, this court really ends up engaging in the same analysis that the Superior Court did.
It's closer to de novo.
Right. It is closer to de novo, but not wholly de novo. But also looks at the affidavit to say, was there a substantial basis for the magistrate to determine that there was a fair probability that certain evidence of a crime was in a certain place at a certain time.
Now you're arguing that we should use a clearly erroneous standard?
I would suggest, I suggest respectfully that when we talk about great deference, and this court also gives great deference in that kind of pass-through review to looking at the affidavit and determining whether or not Superior Court was right or wrong in determining that, also says in the case law that we're going to give great deference to the magistrate, to the initial issuing magistrate. The problem is, what does that mean? And yes, the state is suggesting that what that means is that there should be a clearly erroneous standard.
Was that argued to the Superior Court judge?
There was really very little talk about the standard of review at the time. It was the normal discussion here of fair probability, using a common sense decision,
well,
and everything like that.
That's understandable because the great deference standard, whatever it means, was clearly the law, and one would have expected the Superior Court judge to give great deference to the findings of the magistrate. But
what we're trying to do is
question. Your position is instead that the Superior Court really gave a de novo analysis of the affidavit.
It did. One, we're trying to do two things. But first, great deference, we're trying to flesh out what does that really mean. And secondly, we are arguing that the court, the Superior Court, no matter what great deference means, whether you this court accepts the state suggestion that in practical terms that means a clearly erroneous standard when looking at the magistrate's action, was he or she clearly erroneous in finding probable cause?
Has any other court adopted that standard?
The Missouri Supreme Court has, Your Honor. We also cited the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Missouri Supreme Court has done it probably most clearly.
Why wouldn't a typical standard we see for a review of administrative bodies in the executive branch be sufficient? Is one could posit that review of the Industrial Accident Board's work, which is also intermediately reviewed by the Superior Court, sets a good standard, which is if there's substantial evidence in the record to support a reasonable person's conclusion that there was probable cause, then we don't substitute our judgment for that. We're simply looking for substantial evidence in the affidavit that could give rise to a reasonable suspicion that there was criminal activity at the precise location described, and the evidence to be seized is properly described in the affidavit. Wouldn't that work?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is very much.
Isn't that what great deference means at the end of the day?
I believe it does.
Just a search for substantial evidence to support a conclusion that a reasonable person would reach based upon that substantial evidence?
Yes. I suggest that's right in line, really, with great deference and substantial basis in the evidence, which is what this court set forth in Smith. And that weaves its way through the federal and state.
The reason I ask the question is I'm trying to figure out, is there some magical policy reason why that civil administrative law review wouldn't work in the situation where we're dealing with constitutional law of superior dimensions when we're talking about the invasion of someone's castle, so to speak, their home?
I think I guess when we talk about terms like is there a substantial basis, is there substantial evidence and things like that, we always look for that test, whether it be abuse of discretion or clear error or whatever. And I guess that's where I'm trying to get to, and that is sharpening what that means to say, if we're talking about great deference, if we're saying there was a substantial basis, we're giving a great deference to the magistrate's finding, what does that end up meaning when we say, but we need the test, we need that standard of review that tells us, are we willing to say this magistrate was clearly in error in finding probable cause on this record? Because I think that's a more useful test in the end, and I think it's one that's more readily understood to say, look, nobody could have done this. That's clearly erroneous.
In the search for whether someone's either made a decision based upon substantial evidence or whether the decision when reviewed is clearly erroneous or not, if there are portions of the affidavit that reasonable people should not rely on, for example, a paragraph that says that this individual had been arrested in the past but in effect had escaped justice by not being found guilty, and that's in an affidavit that has little to do with whether or not there are drugs on the location at the time and place described, can that kind of comment be excised by the reviewing court?
Yes.
Treated as if it didn't exist?
Yes, I believe so.
How are we comfortable to know that it didn't overly influence the judgment of the magistrate?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's very similar to the Franks type situation where we must excise other things that may be reckless, there's reckless disregard for the truth, and that exercise is set forth in Franks, and I think the court would use the same type of exercise here. And to get to the specifics of this case, where the court took great umbrage, the Superior Court took great umbrage to the fact that there was discussion of the prior drug arrest, I think the court needs to look at it for what it was, and that is, if we give that the worst possible reading for the state, then all the magistrate could not do is say, well, it's more likely he has drugs on this occasion because he had drugs on this occasion. But the confidential informant's knowledge of that informs how close these confidential informants are to this person. He is somebody who is very comfortable talking to these people about it, and that goes to their credibility and their reliability. It shows he's willing to talk about, here's why I changed, here's what I'm changing to, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing. In the end, what happened here was they did several months of investigation. On April 4th, the confidential source number 2 calls for the third time and says he's received ounces of cocaine that he's going to sell. That is in the affidavit, I believe it's paragraph 8 or 9. They set up surveillance that night. They see Vincent Pfeiffer go there. They see Vincent Pfeiffer leave. They stop Vincent Pfeiffer, and he has oxycodone on him. He says he has a prescription. They look for and that he has a prescription bottle inside. He does not. He also is deceptive with them, although we don't know what they mean by deceptive about where he is coming from. They immediately go to court 20. And in fact, that happens about 8:20 to 8:30. The warrant is applied for at 9:30. Again, we're talking about a house, and we're talking about whether or not there's reason to believe there's evidence there at a particular time. They do it forthwith, get a warrant, and then go in and find the drug evidence that they find. We suggest that when anyone was to put a fair probability, to use the practical common sense, non-technical type of analysis that must be needed in an affidavit of probable cause, that's exactly the type of probable cause that would allow for a warrant to be issued. Instead, what the Superior Court did was almost everything wrong. Excuse made, for instance, the Vincent Pfeiffer stuff. Well, maybe he did have a prescription. Well, maybe he went in with it. Things like that. That's not giving the magistrate the great deference to say, look, I made this view of the facts. That is, he just bought them from there, and there's no other reason for him to have them.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning again. May it please the Court, my name is John Deckers on behalf of Joint Appellees Holden and Lusby. And with the permission of the Court, I'll be making the first 15 minutes of comments, and Mr. Foley would like to have a few minutes of comments. I think it's important to note at the outset that there really is no dispute here regarding the standard or the fact that the state court correctly articulated the standard of review and indicated that it was following that standard of review. There's also no...
Well, there's a certain translation from basketball known as a head fake. You can say you're following the standard of review, but at the end of the day, the question is, did you?
And I think that's really the crux of the state's argument. The state complains about the result, and the state complains that the court, even though it has correctly cited the standard, stated that it's following the standard, has correctly cited all of the facts that are relevant for the determination, the state wants this court to presume that the trial court did not follow, did not do exactly what it said in two locations in its opinion, both at the beginning and at the end, that it was giving great deference to the magistrate's decision. But I think ultimately what the state, complains about perhaps, is that the trial court did not perceive itself to be a rubber stamp. And I think therein lies the request that the state is making of this court to unsettle longstanding jurisprudence.
But why don't you explain to us what you believe the words "great deference" mean? How does one actually, in operation put that standard forward in analyzing the magistrate's work.
Okay. I think great deference means the search for a substantial basis to support a reasonable belief that probable cause existed. That is it.
I'm intrigued by that. You say a substantial basis. Is that something different than substantial evidence that would support it? Substantial basis sounds like something more likely than not to me. How would you define substantial basis?
I think a substantial basis requires a fact-based analysis of the information contained within the four corners. I think that a substantial basis is a conclusion drawn from those facts. I'm not certain that I understand the distinction between substantial basis and substantial evidence, Your Honor.
Well, I'll explain to you what may be the distinction. Substantial evidence simply means credible evidence that could lead to a reasonable person concluding that there was probable cause to believe that there were drugs at that location and that the drugs indicated would be found if a search was authorized. Substantial basis sounds like something more than simply evidence to support it. It had to be a basis beyond just facts that would support the conclusion that it was more likely than not that drugs were at that location at that particular time. Substantial basis sounds more like a burden of proof than a simply addressing facts that were present from which a reasonable person could, by inference, if not by exact fact, conclude that there's a reasonable basis to believe probable cause existed.
Well, I think regardless of which of those standards the court is looking at, substantial basis or substantial evidence.
Well, you tell us which one we should look at.
I believe that
I am as perplexed as Mr. Wallace about our great deference standard. I have no clue what that means, even though I may have been involved at some point in time in my youth of 60 or 61 addressing that standard. I have no idea what that tells a Superior Court judge.
I believe the language of our jurisprudence, both this court and the United States Supreme Court, requires a substantial basis analysis to directly answer the court. But it's also important to look at that analysis within the context of...
Maybe I missed it, but tell me again what you believe substantial basis means.
I believe that substantial basis means a fact-based search to believe, support the magistrate's decision and to support that the magistrate had a reasonable belief that probable cause existed. And I think that in determining whether the magistrate had a reasonable belief that probable cause existed, again, we're talking about the nexus between the items that sought to be found and Holden's residence, we have to look at the information that's provided by the confidential informant.
All right, Mr. Wallace suggests that in order to determine whether there's a substantial basis from which one could draw a reasonable conclusion of probable cause, that you as the reviewing Superior Court judge must find that the magistrate's conclusion was clearly erroneous. How do you respond to that?
See, respectfully, I think that adds more uncertainty to the role of the intermediate reviewing court, because I think that I think when you're going for a clearly erroneous standard with a presumption of correctness, I believe is what the state is asking this court to follow, I think that's code for rubber stamping. And I think that the United States Supreme Court, I think this court repeatedly has said, and I think the trial court has correctly observed, that it is not a rubber stamp, that it has...
a substantial basis of code for, at least in administrative law, substantial evidence really doesn't mean substantial evidence. It just means some evidence, which if believed, would support the finding of fact which is made. Is that what it means here, substantial basis? Means some evidence from which an inference could be drawn to support probable cause?
I think it's more than some evidence.
In this particular case, let me characterize the state's argument. A confidential informant said, Holden told the confidential informant he was selling oxycodone from his house. The house was put under surveillance. Someone went in and out in 10 minutes and was later apprehended with oxycodone. That constituted probable cause to think that there was oxycodone in the house. At least that's what the magistrate concluded. So tell us why, if you give that scenario great deference, you don't uphold the issuance of the warrant.
I think those facts are a step towards determining whether there's a nexus. But I think those facts also have to be looked at within the totality of the circumstances. This is a four-month investigation, supposedly, by the police. There were three separate surveillances of this home. None of the informants, by the way, the things that the Superior Court found to be distinguishing are textbook methods of corroborating the information from a confidential informant. Controlled buys, direct observations of a police officer, of indicia of drug sales.
Well, why is it in a deferential review, why is it appropriate to talk about what wasn't there instead of focusing on what was in the affidavit and determining whether the affidavit offered a substantial evidence from which a reasonable conclusion could be drawn that there was probable cause to issue the warrant? Why do you go through a checklist of things that didn't happen as if in order to get a warrant, as if in order to establish probable cause, if you did not check eight boxes and you only check six, you didn't get it. If you check seven out of eight, maybe you'd get it. But in order to assure the warrant, you have to check all eight. Why is that an appropriate review?
Well, see, I respectfully disagree, have a different perception of this of the Superior Court's decision. I don't perceive the Superior Court establishing its own recipe or establishing or setting
then
forth
why bring
its
up
own
the
judgment.
Control by?
Well, because the Superior Court didn't write a one-sentence opinion. The Superior Court explained its decision in the context of other cases in which probable cause has been found. I think it's reasonable. I think it's expected. I think all courts, this court itself, will look to other cases in order to compare, contrast, distinguish. And I think that's what the Superior Court was doing here. I don't think the Superior Court was substituting its own judgment or establishing its own checklist. I think that the Superior Court was pointing out that the information of the confidential informants was uncorroborated. And you know, this court, the Superior Court...
Let me stop you right there. Uncorroborated or simply not as well corroborated as it might have been under other circumstances as explained in other cases?
Well,
isn't there a distinction?
I think what was corroborated in this particular case was non-incriminating information, address, girlfriend, car. That's what was corroborated. On three separate occasions, the police had opportunities to corroborate. And in fact, what we submit is that the police investigation discredited what the informants told, because the informant said there's such an extreme amount of foot traffic in this home that the roommates had to have known what was going on.
Why doesn't the arrest of Pfeiffer in possession of oxycodone corroborate the confidential informant?
As I indicated, I think it's a step towards that bridge, towards that nexus bridge. But I think that the arrest of Pfeiffer would have more relevance if Pfeiffer said he bought drugs from Holden, or if Pfeiffer was one of several people exiting the residence that evening in a fashion that was indicative of drug sales. Or I think, as this case found it in the Morgan decision, I think it would take on more relevance if it was Holden who was actually leaving the residence with drugs. So we can't ignore the fact that Pfeiffer was found in possession of oxycodone.
And he also gave a deceptive answer as to where he'd been, right?
But I'm not really sure what that means, candidly.
Does that mean he lied?
We're not sure what that means. He was deceptive.
I'm confused by that. Didn't the police see him go into the house?
I'm not sure what the phrase, he was deceptive about where he had been coming from.
No, I understand. You just said that. But he could have said, I just came from the defendant's house. Or he wouldn't have said the defendant, but the named defendant's house.
because the police just saw him come from there. But he didn't say that. He didn't honestly say from where he just came. How is that not being deceptive?
Well, we interpret that he did not say he came from there, but I'm not sure that the affidavit actually says that he lied about not coming from Holden's house. It is perhaps an inference that may be drawn, but I'm not sure that the affidavit actually says he lied about not coming from Holden's house. It just says he was deceptive about where he was coming from. It is one factor for consideration within the totality of the circumstances, but this court has routinely required independent police investigation in order to confirm both the reliability of the informant and the trustworthiness of the information that the informants are providing. Another factor that the court cited as a textbook example of corroborating the information provided by informants is predictive behavior on the part of the informants. And there was no such predictive behavior on the part of the informants in this case. I see that I have a short period of time left. I think that in this particular case, where the Superior Court has correctly enunciated the standard, correctly established the facts under consideration, and has stated that it is following the standard, I think it's I don't think there's any justification, I don't think there's any established jurisprudence that would allow this court to presume that the court did not do exactly what it said it was doing. I think the problem with this warrant is not with the Superior Court. I think the problem with this particular warrant, unlike the very meticulous and detailed warrant that we saw in Gates, for example, the problem is inadequate work product, which leaves the magistrate or leaves the reviewing court to not draw inferences, but to make substantial leaps and conclusions that simply are not set forth with sufficient detail within the warrant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, members of the panel, good morning. Tom Foley on behalf of Ms. Lusby. There's probably a dozen, two dozen search warrants that are sought every week in this state. And the fact that a handful of those search warrants are reviewed by a Superior Court judge and quashed is a good thing. That the notion that the police are going to all of a sudden start doing warrantless searches, I agree with Justice Holland, is far-fetched. And I think that the notion that a Superior Court judge is doing a head fake when she articulates a standard very carefully and at least two or three times says that it's her duty to pay great deference. And the question to Mr. Deckers of what's a substantial basis mean, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, Leon said a substantial basis means that there's sufficient information to support a reasonable magistrate, not necessarily me, but a reasonable magistrate from signing the warrant.
Well, that would be the same thing as our IAB review standard, which is substantial evidence then.
I think it's pretty close, frankly. And but the problem here is I think that's sort of what it means. It's substantial basis means was there a reasonable basis for the magistrate to sign the warrant?
But here, was the problem of substantial basis the Superior Court's assessment of the credibility of the confidential informant? Is that why there wasn't a substantial basis, or was there greater concern beyond credibility?
It's the nexus. There's three things that go into a warrant, and that is the reliability of the mouthpiece, which, you know, informants are a suspect class to begin. They're trying to curry favor. What's the detail, and what's the corroboration? Do they build the bridge from the mouthpiece to the place to be searched? And that's where the court in this case had a problem, because the detail here was terrible and the corroboration was almost non-existent. And the state wants to say, oh, well, believe everything the informants are telling us in the warrant, but don't believe Mr. Pfeiffer. who said, who never made any remark that he had obtained the oxycodone from that particular residence. And in fact, Mr. Pfeiffer was not arrested, as Your Honor answered. There was nothing in the affidavit that he was ever arrested or charged with any wrongdoing. So there has to be something more than Mr. Holden's still in the drug game. The question is...
Holden's residence is in Todd Estates?
Yes.
Well, the affidavit says, Pfeiffer was also deceptive with officers when asked where he was coming from. Pfeiffer admitted that he went to a residence in Todd Estates to visit a friend, finally admitted, Carl Lewis. Is there any connection of Carl Lewis to the Holden residence?
He may have been one of the people there. We don't know, but the police never articulated in the affidavit what exactly he was deceptive in remarking about where he had been. And it, you know, again, as Mr. Decker said, the affidavit is the work product of the investigation. And here it's just, there's just not enough meat on the bone for a regional magistrate to have made the jump, the nexus, that there was contraband in the Holden residence on April 4th, 2011. And that's where the court had the problem. And so as the court goes through and makes analysis, we always compare and contrast in search and seizure and Fourth Amendment analysis. We have standards, reasonable suspicion, probable cause, consent, vehicle searches. There's always a comparing and contrasting with other cases because that's how we kind of find the standard over time. And, you know a bad movie when you see one, you know a good movie when you see one. And sometimes when you talk about it, you compare and contrast. This was a terrible warrant. It was absent of anything to build that bridge, that corroboration from the mouthpieces being the informants to the place to be searched. And I think the court, you know, instead of just doing a one-sentence opinion, gave a very thorough analysis. And I don't think we can assume there was a head fake here when the judge clearly outlined a long-standing precedent that this court's followed, the U.S. Supreme Court's followed, and then all of a sudden assumed that she just ignored that.
Help me understand your position on the application of the great deference standard. If the warrant issues, and in reviewing it with great deference to the magistrate, there's a set of facts that basically brings you to a fork in the road. One inference is a innocent explanation, and another inference is probable cause. Is the great deference, does that require acceptance of the probable cause inference under that circumstance, or can the reviewing court say, no, because there's a fork in the road, there's not enough?
No, I think if you hit a fork in the road, the tie goes to the runner. But there, it has to be supported, again, the totality of the circumstances have to have that bridge there. So you can't just take one reasonable inference in isolation and say that that's the fork in the road. You have to look at the whole warrant and say, is there enough meat on the bone here for the magistrate to have ruled as they did? So I think tie does go to the runner. Tie does go to the magistrate. But you didn't have that here. They weren't even close. It was a start, but again, they were nowhere near building a bridge to the house. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not surprisingly, I absolutely agree with Mr. Foley that at that fork, the tie does go to the magistrate in the finding of probable cause. That's not what the Superior Court did here. Look alone at the Pfeiffer situation. The very last two pages, what the Superior Court judge does is say, I'm not going to give that inference that he bought those drugs there because it wasn't a controlled buy, because we don't know whether he walked in with them. The police didn't do enough to determine whether or not he really did have a prescription when he said there's a prescription bottle in the car. They went and looked, and there was no prescription bottle in the car. And then she criticizes them for not doing more. I don't know what more you do. Do you go check all the Walgreens to see whether or not he has them or what they do? A magistrate could look at that fork and say, looking at the totality, he just bought the drugs there. Of course I should issue this warrant an hour later because warrants... are based on whether or not something may be in a place at a particular time, and when you're talking about drugs, that may mean they're gone soon thereafter. A reasonable, rational magistrate looked at it and said, yeah, the fair inference is, because he's lying about where he just came from, he seems to be lying about whether or not he had these in a prescription. By the way, they describe how they're found. They're in his hand, no bottle, no anything else, right after he just left Holden's house, that he just bought them there. That's not what the Superior Court did. He's right. She wrote a very long opinion in this case, and a lot of it is exactly that. Here's why that magistrate was unreasonable in these findings, and never, that's one inference. I believe it does get back to the standards that we've talked about. Substantial evidence, substantial basis means, is there evidence that has some substance to it? And it's clear, it's the review is what this court does every day. And that is, if there are two opposing views that are supported by the evidence, it does not overturn any finding that is supported by one view of the evidence that's reasonable. That's not what the Superior Court did here. That's where it went wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.